Dear Professor Olberts, President of the University, Mr. Matthias Betzger, representing the European Commission in Germany, Professor Bernes of the Walter Hallstein Institute, dear professors, ladies and gentlemen, students, my dear friends, I am a little bit thankful for the fact that someone found a title for this conversation, and the title being, among other words, the word challenges. Because exactly what we are dealing with today in the problems that you have outlined are challenges. If we had homemade or national-made perfect solutions, we would probably not be here, because things would go on in absolutely normality. And so I'm happy that the word challenge is there. And throughout my experience, I must say that this word continues to be present in my way of looking to things, or at things, of social phenomena, everything that is going on in our very big multicultural and diverse world. But I must tell you that my biggest experience until I finished office, the recent experience as High Representative is a different one, but what is the political experience I recall with more impressive painting is when I was mayor of Lisbon. Not that I simplify the tasks of a president of the Republic in my period. It was, as it usually is, as we can see from today, is complicated, yes. But the municipality of Lisbon, being the capital of the country, and already in the 1990s, had a big group of different minorities, not compared to what it has today, but gave me the first experience in how to deal, for example, with housing, medical services, education, what to do with illegal immigrants, which we had quite a lot at the time. And I remember with a certain pride, if you may allow, that in 1991, when this was not, in my country at least, a normal thing to do, I instituted in the municipality a consultative body of the representatives of migrants and the city administration presided by then the then mayor, which was myself. And that was an extraordinary experience of effort, dialogue, understanding, etc. So I thank the President. I wish you well in your new mandate. That rector is always a difficult task, but I wish you well. And I thank the representative of the European Commission and Mr. Sabatil, who I've been gladly meeting many times in recent months, for the support and the understanding. And of course, to the director, Professor Pernes of the Hallstein Institute. I am happy that you mentioned music. It's a pity that I forgot everything, as I forgot the German language, which as a law student in my country, one had to do it, had to study it. And I spoke German, and then suddenly it went away. So if I stay 15 days, a little bit comes through, but I can never stay 15 days. So it's a pity that I, although with pleasure, will address you in English. So don't forget the word challenge. I have in my speech many questions which I don't consider resolved. What I do, if I wanted to say what is around this lecture, I would call it intervention. They have been very prestigious and breathtaking lectures in the Humboldt University, which everyone knows by heart what happened here in in many, many times. It's the word I would like to really to stick to everyone is the word, the need for awareness. And this is really what is around what I'm going to try to say. So, ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to have this honor and the privilege of addressing you here at this university, and would like to thank Professor Olberts for the opportunity to mull over in public a few, I would say private, but now public, will be public, thoughts on Europe. The Humboldt brothers and this university, home to so many great Europeans that shaped our world over the past two centuries, are indeed inspirational for anyone who dares to wander in the arcane world of our present times. The Humboldt brothers lived at an age when intellectual, scientific, and cultural life in Europe was dominated by rationalist worldviews in which everything was open to rational examination and criticism. The extraordinary development of scientific thought, in particular of natural sciences, but also the emergence of economic and political thought, as well as the French Revolution in 1789, laid the foundations of modern Western political and intellectual culture. The interesting point here is made by Habermas, who credits to the Enlightenment the rise of what he called the public sphere in Europe, even if public at that time remained rather exclusive and limited to an elite of intellectuals or men of letters. However, this emergence of public opinion or civil society allowed for a kind of collective process of self-consciousness that resulted in democracy, which is integral for our contemporary debates. This is all about the times when the founders of this university lived, all about the birth of modern Europe, brought by the collapse of the Ancien Régime. Idealizing the past, ladies and gentlemen, is not a good thing, but forgetting it is much worse. These are words by the late Tony Judd. I couldn't agree more with him, because one has to keep an eye on the past by looking into the challenges of the present if a better future is to be built on. So let me deliver my remarks as a sort of a musical composition in two tempos. The first tempo is from past to present. Ladies and gentlemen, over the past decade, this tribune has been used by honorable speakers to go beyond the circumstantial evidence that grabs headlines on European affairs, to articulate concerns and express their vision for Europe. Indeed, one may wonder why Europe is always in such need of a vision, always caught somewhat in a kind of a deficit. Deficit of conceptualization, deficit of attention, deficit of trust, deficit of reconciliation. To a certain extent, the reason for this deficit is quite simple and natural. After all, the European Union is a complex ongoing process which is really never made, but always in the making. As an open system with many parts in an intricate arrangement, that continuously interact with the environment, here spoken in a very broad sense, the European Union is very much an unpredictable and uncertain social and political artifact. The modern scientific paradigm of information sciences shed new light on the European Union and allows us to understand how this unique an unprecedented political project is linked to a worldview rooted in a long intellectual, cultural, scientific, and civilizational tradition, shared in various degrees and with nuances by all Europeans. I don't think that an ambitious, uniting political project such as this one could ever have been built out of the rubble of a war-torn century had we lacked the common ground that makes Europeans share a number of basic beliefs or cognitive, affective, and ethical assumptions about the world. Indeed, in such extreme circumstances, the survival of all belligerents was at stake, and a new beginning was absolutely necessary for everyone. What emerged from the famous Hague Congress in 1948 was precisely a new soul for Europe. I would very much like to insist on this point. How could one dare to embark on such an ambitious search for unity if peoples were not sharing a number of common beliefs, or if a consensus between their different worldviews was not possible? By this common ground, I mean the cultural heritage that underpins the European history and that ultimately allows us to shape a sense of belonging to the same group or community and build up a common future. With the risk in all the personalities in the room, with the risk of annoying all of you, I might be tempted to point out our common heritage, some elements of this common heritage. The Greco-Roman legacy, democracy rooted in free speech and debate among people's representatives in the agora or public square, and justice as the starting point of law or jus that regulates the exercise of political power, freedom, and equality. Our Judeo-Christian roots, which by way of tensions and rivalry are linked with Islam, forming together what some call the Mediterranean monotheism. The rift between East and West that grew in the Middle Ages and was further accentuated by the fall of Constantinople in 1453 and its integration in the Ottoman Empire, marking the starting point of Europe's identification with the West, regardless of any geographical reason, which still feeds many of the ambiguities of contemporary Europe. The unfading archetype of the empire that Charlemagne founded in Aix-la-Chapelle, a long way from the Mediterranean, renovated by the ideal of Christian universality and the assimilation of Roman law, unable to solve the crucial issue of whether supreme authority should be vested in the Pope or in the Emperor. And the everlasting breakup of Christian unity and the emergence of a Europe of Christianities, Greek Orthodox in the East, in the West Catholicism, later divided into Protestantism in the North and Catholicism in the South. And the birth of nations, of course, as an exercise in sovereignty endowed with a national religion and language which divided Europe politically, and that the French Revolution provided with political power. Let me stress this last point, because modern European history is all about nation states affirming their sovereignty, zealous of their authority and independence, and seeking to maintain a certain balance, if possible, a just balance of power according to the Treaty of Westphalia. Nevertheless, as we all know, European history is also riddled with hegemonic ambitions, rivalries, alliances, and adverse collisions. Collisions in which big states confront big states, in which the small states acting as a counterweight, forming alliances here and there according to their interests at stake. The principle of nationalities as an expression of the political goal of making state and nation coincide was progressively asserted during the 19th century and eventually consolidated as a principle of international law expressed in the right of nations to self-determination. The decolonization that followed World War II, corresponding to the implementation of this right, brought, in fact, a new challenge for European nations in search for a new world map where Europe ceased to be the center and just became another continent. A continent among others, and that, furthermore, was arbitrarily divided for 50 years, which European integration strongly helped to reunite, pushing its borders further to the east and to the southeast. The reunification of Europe raises indeed a geopolitical question of the eastern borders, just as it makes us ponder on the finalities of the common project. These are open questions that need, of course, further reflection. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, Europe is aimed at securing peace and prosperity by guaranteeing frontiers, development, and mutual understanding among peoples. But is it all? Can we push frontiers and move borders further and further each time? Are there geographical limits to this political project? Is this related to the vexed question of the European identity, to the conception Europeans have about themselves? In my view, what is special about Europe is to be found in its diversity, in its capacity to value differences and integrate diversity of language, religions, philosophies, social organization, lifestyles. So, my first point, we need to recognize our differences so that we can respect them and, of course, learn from them. But second point, we have also to know what unites us across our diversities, contrasts, and contradictions. What binds us together? What we want and how much we can do together? How best we can use our strengths to overcome our weaknesses? This is, of course, all about our identity, a question that cannot be seen as a luxury. Not only because perpetual self-questioning is part of our mindset, but also because identities are always in the making as a continuously building up process. Indeed, in our quest for identity, we need for sure to look backward to the past, but only just as we absolutely have to look also forward to the future, because, and I quote here Amartya Sen, because of our freedom to determine our loyalties and priorities between our affiliations, the different groups to all of which we may belong. And this is, I think, a very important contribution from the Nobel Prize, Amartya Sen. So let me get now to the second tempo, which I called From Present to Future. Ladies and gentlemen, in creating the European Community, the coal and steel community, and later the common market, the main objective was, as we all know, peace. But after 50 years, are the cries of never again, in spite of the reminders of the tragedies not only of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Kosovo, but also of Chechnya, are these cries audible enough for today's young Europeans who are lucky enough to have been brought up over the times of peace? I really don't think so. In spite of the strong need for peace, security, and prosperity, war as a military threat within European borders is no more, and so much the better, of course, is no more one of the top concerns of peoples, and therefore, it cannot be seen as a driving force for further European integration. Moreover, we are probably too blasé to believe in the European dream as it was in the aftermath of the war, as former President Jacques Delors once put it. Therefore, we need to refocus the raison d'etre of the European integration on what really unites peoples, on what supports each other's efforts, thanks to the added value of a common approach, joint actions, and common policies. As a political project, the European Union has to give answers to the big challenges that our European countries are faced with. Adaptation, to give you some. Adaptation of our market economies to the great and fast changes taking place. Adaptation of the so-called European social model to new demographic and budgetary constraints, adaptation of our democracies to cope with pluralism, respect human rights and minorities, adaptation, finally, of our societies to living in a world village that makes increasing diversity inevitable. These are our wars, peaceful wars, but our wars, the European wars of the 21st century, that Europe has to fight with soft power tools. Because although prosperous and provided with a solid acquis, Europe is not freed from needs and aspirations of its peoples. But the wars to be fought are against poverty and unemployment, against inequalities, against economic decline, against divides within our societies, against exclusion, xenophobia, discrimination, and related forms of intolerance. If Europe does not bring some assurance that concerns and aspirations of its citizens are taken up into consideration, if it does not add to states' action, if it does not overcome their limitations, one may wonder what this marriage contract is all about. In my view, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for Europe to take the fears of its citizens seriously and address them. Fears feed frustrations, resentment, and hostility. Fears ignite tensions that may degenerate into violence. The crisis that we are living today in Europe, economic, financial, social, cultural, and moral, has to be tackled at all levels, in particular at the European level. Because in my view, it is not only one more circumstantial crisis, but a true paradigm shift that we are faced with. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot ignore the increasing diversity of our European societies. As I said, be it ethnic, linguistic, religious, or cultural. This diversity is really generating growing anxiety among populations, as it was mentioned before, driving communities apart and putting democracies under mounting pressures. In spite of being integral to Europe, cultural diversity has become a topical issue for our societies. The success of many far-right anti-immigration parties in various elections in European countries is, in my view, a clear symptom of a growing malaise and unease. It illustrates how fears and prejudices may build into something like a social time bomb across Europe if they are not addressed properly and forcefully. The most widely accepted explanation for the success of extreme right parties suggests that they are a response to economic distress, fears about the future of the social welfare state, and a reaction to the growing multiculturalization of our societies. Probably all these questions are at stake. This is why we need an European agenda and leadership to confront this challenging situation. But let's avoid polarizing the debate and ignite tensions by making inflammatory statements about our shortcomings in dealing with migration issues. Let's also avoid denying problems and face challenges ahead. As someone put it to me recently, neither victimization nor denial. So let us ask what went wrong and where are the problems. Let us be honest and recognize that most of the times diversity stands for migration, and that in continental Europe, immigration and Islam are almost synonymous. Let's assume that cultural diversity is a problem in Europe insofar as it relates to migration and to the integration of migrants. Let us ask why both Western publics and Europe's Muslim minorities, particularly in cities and urban areas, feel quite anxious about their mutual bad relations. Ladies and gentlemen, but what is at stake, really, in Muslim minorities in Europe, as I see it? In my view, there are at least three main issues. A demographic issue, since estimations point out that Muslims will account for about 10% of the population of the EU by 2020. an integration issue, but let's be clear, many problems affecting Muslims are common to other immigrant groups, and finally, an identity issue. Indeed, the arrival of immigrants to any society, and in any society, has an impact on the host country's sense of self. Let's not delude ourselves with this. It does have an impact. It happens, for instance, in the United States with the Latino migrants. It also happened in the past with flows of migration from southern countries like Italy, Spain, and Portugal. Now, in my view, the point here is that there is a clash between Islamic and Western societies, and let's admit it. However, as the writer William Pfaff has very recently put it, it is not the Huntington's clash of civilizations because, number one, Islam and the West, although religious rivals, so to speak, within the same civilization, are members of the Mediterranean monotheism. And number two, because civilizations are cultural phenomena and don't go to war with each other as if they were nations, contrary, in fact, to what Professor Huntington wrongly pretended. Now there is a clash, and we need to acknowledge it. This clash is, first of all, a clash of ignorance or ignorances, because this essential connection between Western and Islamic history is widely unknown, ignored, or simply misunderstood. But there is also a clash of worldviews that makes a consensus between the two difficult but not impossible to achieve. This is all about world politics, but also about fundamental questions concerning values, concerning beliefs, and concerning customs. I will not address the issue of world politics here, but I would like to focus on the resurgent role of religion that is witnessed almost everywhere as a new challenge that has to be tackled. Even in Europe, where secularization of religious behavior made it a private affair, and secularism is responsible for the clear separation of state and religion, religious movements are in fact thriving. Now, the critical question to be asked is as follows: what can we do at policy level to promote constructive dialogue between religious and secular systems? The problem in Europe seems to be that secularism no longer manages to ensure a constructive dialogue between religious worldviews, namely between Christianity and Islam, a dialogue that is possible, fruitful, and necessary. I'm sorry. So my assumption here is twofold. Being considered a system of beliefs, different religions can, if they have sufficient beliefs in common, hold a constructive dialogue between them and allow for cross-cultural exchanges. In this case, a consensus between different worldviews can be achieved. I'm not speaking about theology. I'm speaking about precisely what I tried to do say in these sentences. Secondly, Christianity and Islam worldviews embrace similar or at least compatible ethical and political commitments. So the following point, I can put it in this way. How religious and secular systems go together and reinforce each other? What are the tools to be used in this approach? What is the role of religious pluralism? I tend to think that we need to reflect further on pluralism, in particular on religious pluralism. Are we confronted with a new religious pluralism? Does it undermine the cultural and social foundations of democracy? Is it the reason why identity politics has become more noticeable, more salient? What's wrong with new religious diversity in secular Europe? Is it pluralism that is failing in our present times? I don't have ready answers to these questions, which I said at the beginning were really challenges. But this is no reason to give up. After all, looking back in history, it seems to me that the relation between pluralism and religion has never been really free of ambiguities. Your Excellencies, how we master the political, social, religious, and cultural tensions that have emerged over the past decade will have a decisive impact on the future and health of democracy in our continent. At least, may I say so, this is my profound conviction, and I should say it here in this university and in this room. This is why I believe that developing the democratic governance of cultural diversity is a major political priority of international, European, national, and local agendas. This is my first concluding point. Second, polarization and extremism in societies are on the increase. In order to tackle this problem, we need to avoid the pitfalls of a fundamentalist secular mindset. I repeat, we need to avoid the pitfalls of a fundamentalist secular mindset. In other words, new strategies to manage and promote interreligious dialogue as part of cultural diversity based on universal human rights should be developed. What does the interface between religious political doctrine and democracy really mean? And how can suspicion between secular and religious political actors be overcome to allow for constructive dialogue? These are again the questions to be asked. It is also time for political decision makers, in my modest opinion, to engage in initiatives underway that organize, facilitate, and study ongoing dialogue processes with diverse religious and secular political movements. These processes aim to enhance and facilitate meaningful dialogue and to explore ways in which decision makers in both contexts can contribute to conflict prevention between as well as within countries and societies. My third point regards migration and integration of migrants in Europe. In my view, a crucial indicator of the success of the entire European project will be the inclusion and integrations of migrants. In this regard, citizenship matters. And eventually we need to go beyond citizenship in the sense of, and I quote Mark Howard in the recent books on the politics of citizenship in Europe, we should really go beyond citizenship in the sense of, and I quote, better understanding the larger principles that citizenship is meant to signify. This means that we need a new European agenda related to migration, integration, and citizenship. We need integrated perspectives and policies on migration and on integration. We need to develop democratic citizenship and participation. We need to learn and to teach intercultural competences to our citizens. We need to create urban strategies and policies for intercultural dialogue. We need to build intercultural and inter-ethnic cities. All this is extremely difficult, very challenging, but I don't think that there is any other way. Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, since its inception, the European project, in which, of course, I am a great believer, the European project has faced many crises. In the 60s, common agricultural policy was the big challenge. In the 73, it was the energy crisis. In the 90s, Europe faced twice a serious economic and financial crisis. At the turn of the century, democratic principles were at stake in one of the member states. More recently, we remember the constitutional treaty crisis of 2004. However, of each of these crises, and I did not mention them all, was an opportunity to go further in the European integration, in other words, to advance its goals. I really trust that once again, Europe will live up to our expectations and that it will show, as it always has done in the past, its capacity to start somewhat like a new life from the ashes of fire, as really a phoenix. So I thank you very much for listening to these challenges. Thank you.